a group of 23 potential revolutionaries, several of whom are present again today. I want to identify them, and we worked out strategies for overthrowing the government of the United States and taking over ourselves on the basis of the best techniques, some of which get practiced in religious circles. And today we're going to talk about how to prevent that sort of thing, or how to overcome that sort of thing. Let me first of all mention, because I tend to gesture and my hands look a mess, that up until about half an hour ago, I was out lumbering with Ernie Zorb down there, 10 Mile Creek in Weedon, cutting up logs and hauling logs up here, and about 3:15, we got a chainsaw caught right in the middle of a tree, a fallen tree. And we couldn't get it loose, and I had to get up and get my clothes changed and get my notes together and so on. I was thinking as I was up at my chalet washing my hands, a famous remark from the Communist Manifesto: "Workers of the world unite! You have nothing to lose but your chainsaw." So as of this point, I don't know whether Ernie got that chainsaw loose or not. He was heading up here to get another one, try to cut it loose from the bottom. But it was about 3.5 feet across on the tree, excellent potential lumber, and it was about 30 feet up from the ground. So you can imagine about how big it was, about this high from the ground. But I'll rejoin him tomorrow, and we'll do our best. Okay, counter-revolutionary activity. We begin by saying, and I love to have people talk with me, you know, so it doesn't bother me in the least bit to throw my notes to one side and talk back and forth, you know, so don't feel that if you interject a comment or ask a question that I'm going to get all upset or anything else. This is supposed to be for your benefit, and hopefully for my benefit. I have a little saying which I remind my colleagues and the faculty here every once in a while, and I think before the end of the summer, somehow or other, I'm going to get it right up here on the reflector screen here, and that is, my little saying is, the oracle is in the audience. I've been here at Holden Village, this is my 7th time in about 9 years, and every single summer I have found that when I spoke profoundly on some topic, there was at least one person in the audience who knew more about it than I did, and who very graciously didn't make this general knowledge. So I always look forward to these sessions to find out what I can learn, and also to find out on what topic we're going to get, because very seldom we end up where we have been. So I'll start talking, and if you want to say something, or if you want to argue with me, or if you want to ask a question, you know, feel free, and we'll run until supper time. We begin by saying that every country has revolutionaries. Just like every body has germs, every body politic has potential revolutionaries. They're always there. Even the best run countries have some people that want a different kind of government, or who would love to overthrow it if they could. And so this is a natural phenomenon. Every country always has people who are revolutionary in character. And they may be revolutionary in character for a variety of reasons. They may be psychopaths. They may be prophets ahead of their time. They may be reactionaries. You know, all kinds of reasons why people become revolutionaries. They may be revolutionaries because their father beat them all the time when they were kids, or they may be revolutionary because their father didn't beat them enough. You know, and they were spoiled rotten. There are all sorts of reasons why people become revolutionaries, and every society has them. But what is important is not, you know, how can you have a society that doesn't have any potential revolutionaries in it, but how can you prevent a revolution from occurring in a country where, you know, there's good reason to believe that you've got a reasonably decent kind of government, possibly even a better form of government than other people happen to have at your time. The revolution tends to become a viable option to people. And I should preface that by saying that revolution is a form of behavior which people engage in only under extreme conditions. Not revolutionaries, but you know, a large number of the people. Revolutionary activity is an extreme form of activity. And it is a form of activity in which large numbers of people engage only when they are feeling extremely outraged. And this is why I suspect that, particularly in our country, we have tended not to get as concerned as we ought to get when people get outraged about something or other. Well, there are certain standard sources of discontent, standard sources of outrage. One is, most obvious one, the rich-poor relationship. If you're operating a kind of economy where there is private possession, which is measurable by money or some other kind of standard, and if the extremes between those that got a lot and those that got little or nothing becomes too much, and if you get too many on the poor side and too few on the rich side, you got trouble. Just like if you get out hiking in the mountains here and you get too much sun too long, you got trouble. And you may get hypothermia or something like that. So also, a political society, if a certain proportion between wealth and poverty is not maintained, if it gets beyond a certain extreme, you get trouble. Now, people will tend to tolerate considerably more than we think they will. But when you reach the extreme of a point of toleration where they won't tolerate it anymore, it has gotten so exaggerated and so much out of hand that you get violence. And you can't stop the thing until it's run its course and people have worked off their frustrations. In addition to this, we've learned, well, probably since World War II, a new kind of idea that relates to this, and that's, well, it's an idea we should have known because it's in Plato's Republic, only he didn't call it what we call it today. And that's the notion of rising expectations. If you maintain a certain proportion of your population down at a certain poverty level, their lifestyle, their level of nutrition, the kind of foods they can ingest and so on, will be of such a character that they will tend to remain that way. And they will tend not to be a problem. Or if they are a problem, they'll be a problem that you can ignore and not kind of protest it. But if you raise their nutritional level up a certain amount, or if you raise their income up a certain amount, all of a sudden they will reach a point where what they want will escalate faster than the capacity of the economy or the capacity of the nation to satisfy it. And so it will always be running faster than what can be done to satisfy it. Now Plato pointed this out. I was reminded of this when you were talking before, Al, about the Seattle business. You remember in the Republic, Plato talks about you reach a certain level in a society where it's a self-sufficient society, and it's a lean society, and you're satisfying basic needs, and everybody's content. But you move beyond that point, and you start stimulating desire. There's no end to the road. And as he says, you then generate the city of pigs. And there's no way you can satisfy that kind of thing because desire always is more than satisfaction. You can always, there's always more you can want than you've got. There is no natural terminus. Now there's a natural terminus to how much nutrition you need. There is a natural terminus to how much clothing you need, as Al was talking about. You can only wear one pair of shoes at a time. And you really only need one pair. So there are certain kind of natural limits when you're operating on a principle of basic need. But when you operate in terms of your basic principle of satisfaction is I want, there are no limits. And it just simply becomes sort of self-generating, bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's just impossible to satisfy. That's what keeps an economy growing and a gross national product getting bigger and bigger, you know. But it's a self-defeating kind of thing, and it's like the little animal in the, what do you call these little things that they run around inside?
Treadmill.
The faster you go, the faster you got to keep running, not to land you with your nose against the bottom. See, and it just gets more and more impossible. And it winds up tighter and tighter and tighter and faster and faster and faster and burns up more and more and more and more energy to keep where you are. Because everything in your culture and your economy is relative to everything else, and so as it all speeds up, you know, you're like Alice and the Queen. You're running as fast as you can to stay where you are. And everybody's getting worn out. Well, at any rate, if these things get out of kilter, people begin to think about alternatives to what they've got in forms of government. Number two is the male-female relationship. If the male-female relationship gets in certain sorts of proportions, you will start getting revolutionary activity also. Now, for centuries, I suspect males have solved this problem the way we solved the problem of the way downtrodden minority, where you maintain them below the level of rising expectations and everything goes fine. You let them start getting up to the level of rising expectations and then you've got troubles. Now, related to the male-female relationship, I suspect is the whole familial business. Now, once again, Al and I didn't confer about this before today, but there are more things he was talking about that relate to what I'm talking about. And when you talk about the larger family, about the social family, one of the sources of problems in a kind of society, or in a political society, a potential source of problems, is producing a kind of society that becomes increasingly competitive family, where each family competes more and more strongly with each other family, or where you operate various aspects of life on a competitive basis, like education, sports, employment, company against company, the economy, your nation against the next nation. If the whole business is set up on a competitive basis, and if your atomic unit is the family, and it is self-contained, and it's us against everybody else, you not only are inviting political disintegration, but you're also inviting potential revolution. Number three is a ruler-rule relationship. If the uses of power begin to move to an extreme, if they either become increasingly centralized and power flows very, very strongly to the center of the political structure, or if it flows with a centrifuge out to the extreme periphery, the people in a pure democracy, you move to either of these extremes, you're asking for trouble. And your economy is starting to get, or your political society is moving in the direction of revolution. And so any kind of political unit that begins where power begins to concentrate more and more into a center around an individual, you know, whether it be Richard Nixon or John Kennedy, you know, from Kennedy to, roughly about from Kennedy to Nixon, the power really concentrated in the center.
Would you say Mrs. Gandhi?
Yeah.
Today, I mean,
right?
She's taken over.
Well, of course, now you've got a politically extraordinary situation there, because she's operating in defiance of the law. Because that court back home, you know, found her in default of the law, and you recall refused. the sentence was that she was not to engage in political life for 6 years, and of course, being premier of the country, that makes it a little difficult for her. And she, of course, then chose to ignore that, and for all practical purposes, has instituted martial law. However, this is a highly dangerous situation for India. And of course, it's much more dangerous than we got in with Mr. Nixon. Although it got pretty hairy in the last days of Mr. Nixon also, and could have been much worse. From the standpoint of maintaining our autonomy in the form of government we have. But India is in an extremely difficult situation now. And the form of government may very well collapse.
What did happen? I didn't hear the news in terms of...
Well, I have to relate it to when I came to the village, because I've not looked at a paper.
I mean, very recently, the last few days, there was Supreme Court. See, she did get a ruling from another judge, you know, that she could continue as the premier.
Yeah, she got like an injunction.
Right.
And then it...
But then the Supreme Court was going to rule just about 2 days ago. Did anybody
know? Does anybody know how they ruled? The assumption that I was going on, and you know, from what I knew about a month ago, was that no way was she going to win.
She was going to subject to it. Just before we came here, I heard it on the radio that the Supreme Court was going to give its decision.
She was attempting to manipulate also the judiciary there. But it's an extremely sensitive situation right now in India for the form of government. And particularly so because there are a number of highly populous areas of India that have gone communist and where she has no control at all. And now if she goes and pulls a little fascist move here and takes over the government and rules under terms of martial law, she is likely to lose
She did take over.
She says there's a national emergency.
She suspended.
Well, yeah. Well, I know, but I mean, she was hoping to get the Supreme Court to find for her so that she could let the emergency pass. And if the Supreme Court finds against her, I would assume that what she's likely to do is to simply continue in defiance of the law. Which means that she will erode even more of her power. Now, she's eroded a lot already in what she did. And, but the situation is very tricky. There is no one other than Mrs. Gandhi who is a figure of sufficient stature to replace her. There was a man for a while, I don't recall his name, who was her war minister and who was extremely anti-American. I don't recall his name. But he was in bad health and he died about 2 years ago. So India very well could suddenly achieve a different form of government. So as that power gets gathered into the center, and you get an explosion. Or if the power zips way out to the extremes, what you tend to get then is anarchy. And then as everything begins to, it's everybody for himself. And then as the whole political structure breaks down, because nobody's cooperating with anybody and everybody's doing his own thing, then what tends to happen is you're sitting wide open for a strong guy to come in and take over, and you've got a dictatorship. So you have to watch the flow of power and the movement of power within a political society, and you got to keep it somehow between extreme centralization and extreme periphery. And of course, we got a number of us Missouri senators sitting around here, and right now we're faced with a problem of extreme centralization of power. And it's going to blow up. No way it can avoid blowing up. Especially with a political outfit that has been used to having the power closer to the periphery than to the center. And there's no way it can avoid blowing up. And those who are concentrating the power seem to be politically insensitive to the facts of political life, which is a little surprising. Okay. Another one is personal frustration if you have a kind of society where the level of nutrition and the level of culture is of such a nature that you're up above this rising expectations level, and where things are going have been going rather well, but you suffer one reverse after another, the individual and the corporate frustration level increases and gets higher and higher and higher and higher, what we call super ego intensity situation, and all of a sudden you start doing strange things. This is what happened to the Germans under the Weimar Republic. You have one reverse after another, and you just can't take it as a nation, particularly if you've got a lot of pride. You've got to have some kind of victories, you know, even if it's only winning an Olympics or something like that, you know. Somehow or other, you've got to have some sorts of achievements to retain corporate self-respect. And if you haven't got it, what invariably do you do? You go and fight a war. Or you, you know, you put in somebody who flatters your ego. And you inevitably engage in aggression. And usually what happens is you change your form of government, because it's not working. And so consequently, these are the sorts of things that one has to watch in a political society to see to it that it's remaining healthy. And if any of these starts to get way out of line or way out of kilter, then you got problems and then you've got troubles. Revolutions are, like most everything else in life, are best prevented by preventive political medicine rather than crisis problem solving. So what are the kind of things that one has to do? Well, I've listed 11 of them, and some of them, strangely enough, once again, will relate to some of the things Al talked about today and also about some of the things he's been concerned about this summer. Number one, a rather obvious one, and that is control the distribution of wealth so that it doesn't get to extremes, so that you don't have a small number of extremely wealthy people or wealthy corporations who are able to manipulate the economy or able to escape it. One of the things which is the strongest source of frustration for the American people today is the American phenomenon of the millionaire who doesn't pay income tax. Now, I suspect that those millionaires that aren't paying income tax, if they really got socked like the rest of us get socked, it would make much difference economically. But it makes a heck of a lot of difference psychologically. And that's much more important. And if people have a feeling that the rich guys can get away with it, but the poor guys get zapped, or the middle class where we all belong, we get zapped for it, and the poor guys don't have to pay anything because they haven't got any money, they get government handouts, and the rich guys, they don't have to pay anything because their lawyers can figure out how to get around the law. You know, the frustration level grows and grows and grows and grows until finally people are ready to do things violently. Another factor that relates to that is this. It is extremely important that one have a tolerable proletarian level. Now, tolerable means extremely small, and a proletarian is a person who has nothing but his capacity to earn. He lives from day to day by what he does. For this very simple reason, suppose that Paulie over here hasn't got a nickel to his name, and there's an opportunity to participate in a revolution to overthrow the United States of America where all the wealth will be equally divided. Does Paulie have anything to lose? Has he got anything to gain? For a while we were acting rather intelligently in our dealings with the Soviet Union in the late years under Mr. Eisenhower. And the Soviet Union began to experience some rising expectation pains. People have felt they had waited long enough for their refrigerator and they wanted it now. And for just a short period of time, we were shipping refrigerators over there at nice prices, and we were sharing expertise and all kinds of things, and a few smart people said, the best way to lick Russian communism is to make American capitalists out of them. Build the rising expectation levels and make them middle class in their values. And they'll get over being revolutionaries because they will have something they don't want to lose. Now, if people in a country, in country X, all have something they don't want to lose, they aren't likely to want to change their country. If what they've got is very, very important to them, more important than chancing losing it in a revolution, they aren't going to be revolutionaries. And revolutionaries are either people who have got nothing to lose, or they're people who are too dumb to know what they're going to lose if they engage in a revolution, or they are people who are going to be unaffected by it, or relatively unaffected by it, or they're going to be better off. And so consequently, one of the smartest ways one can avoid revolutions is seeing to it that everybody has got something that he doesn't want to lose. But we never think that far. Jerry's favorite remark, we're always, one of the cutest characteristics and frustrating characteristics about us middle classers is we're always worrying about how we can look out for the interests of the guy that makes $100,000 a year so that he doesn't get hurt in some way or another. We're always trying to help him out. You know, we don't worry about the guy who makes $1,000 or $2,000 a year, but we sure worry about the guy who makes $100,000 or more so that he's not inconvenienced by anything we do. But what we have to do, and I suspect in talking about things like negative income tax, guaranteed annual income, and so on, probably one of the smartest things we can do politically is something like that, so that every citizen of the United States has something to lose that's important to him if we change our government. And we'll get one of the most stable governments on earth. Okay, number two.
This, could I break in there that
sure.
I read that this is one of the reasons that Khrushchev was put down by his enemies within the Politburo, that he tried to put the emphasis more on consumer goods as over against heavy industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the others foresaw that difficulty, that once he gave them shoes and all that sort of thing, that he would have
they
just a bundle of trouble.
They were going capitalist hand over fist,
right.
And the other guys realized that all of a sudden it was going to be another United States of America,
right.
About 1930s variety, and there went communism out the window.
And there would be the control of the actual people,
sure.
Too.
Yeah. Well, sure. Then you're on the treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Second, the matter of legal rights. I'll give you an example of little kids. What do little kids playing on the playground, what do they find most frustrating? If their sense of justice is outraged, and they seem to have a kind of natural sense of right and of justice, if a child feels that another child is treading on his rights or he's getting unjust treatment, he gets frustrated. And then if he approaches, the authority figure, the teacher or the parent or so on, and he doesn't get justice, he really gets frustrated. And when he's little, he cries. And maybe he can cry it out of his system. But he gets bigger, he can't cry it out of his system. And it just kind of eats at him. And he starts building up animosities and hatreds and so on toward the other person because he didn't get his rights. Now, any country that's as big and complex as ours and with as antiquated a court system as we have daily is courting revolution. All you got to do is live in the Chicago area like Al and I do and get involved in a court case. Even a minor court case. Oh, you get frustrated. And you wonder how justice ever occurs. And all the deals that get made, and all the stalling that occurs, and all of the putting off of the cases, all of which builds frustration, 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 frustration. And the people who are in courts the oftenest, most often, are usually the lower class people, and the frustration level just simply builds, and you know, and it's you create a powder keg situation. And all the deals that get made, and all the stalling that occurs, and all of the putting off of the cases, all of which builds frustration, 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 frustration. And the people who are in courts the oftenest, most often, are usually the lower class people, and the frustration level just simply builds, and you know, and it's you create a powder keg situation. And so consequently, one of the most intelligent things a country can do is, as fast as possible, achieve speedy and equitable distribution of justice. And speed of justice is probably even more important than equitable. If a case gets handled right away, an awful lot of frustration level disappears. One of the primary reasons why the British have tended to be more successful than we have in the area of murder, and the rate of murder, has been speedy justice. Not kind of justice, but speedy justice. You don't sit around for 2 or 3 years before the case comes up.
I have a lawyer friend who made a point there, though, that almost always, he said somewhere around 90% of the time, it is the defense. That is, we have built into our system to be so careful that we don't...
Right.
It's the defense itself that asks for a stay or more time to prepare.
Well, that's right. And it's the cult of the individual that Al was talking about before that relates to it.
Yeah.
We have built so many safeguards to protect the individual against society, against the state, and so on, that we can frustrate the whole bit. We have a frustration system operating.
Have to try to keep a good balance between those two.
Right.
Because the complete totalitarian system, way out,
yeah,
they favor speedy trials too. You know, where the person that just has a hearing and then bang, he's taken out and shot. And so the speedy can go to the extreme, too far.
And you notice you're picking up the point, you got this extreme and you got this extreme, and somewhere in between there is where you got the healthy political situation. And what has tended to happen to us, particularly in the large metropolitan areas, is that our courts are you know, they're just jammed up. And something has to be done about it, and that's not new with me. Chief Justice Berger is one of the first things he said when he became Chief Justice. Now, a little bit has been done, but there's a great deal more that needs to be done. Before we're going to get the whole crime situation under control, isn't it? And it's not just, you know, it's crimes like embezzlement and running a crooked bank and other sorts of things also, as well as you know, violent crimes. But this is an area where if this gets sour, or where people feel they're not going to get justice, where they cannot go to the courts and have their day, that the country's in trouble. And you will be building in the direction of revolution. What in the French Revolution, what was the first building that was burned down?
Bastille.
The Bastille. It's a big prison where people were put because other people who had political power didn't like them. And that's where they kept them. And that was the symbol of injustice. And that's the first thing they went for, burned down the Bastille. So this is a place that has to get watched. Number three, decentralization of power. One of the things that we've learned, strangely enough, from Mao Zedong is the more the power is at the point where it needs to be used, the better off the society is. The more decentralized power is, and the more power is put where it can intelligently be used, the better off you are. Once again, you've got to watch that extreme that the power is at the periphery and you have paralyzed government. It can't move, because then you're a sitting duck. And you get a dictatorship that develops aggressive yearnings, and before you can mobilize your power to centralize it, to make decisions, to react, you're stuck, or you're conquered. So once again, there has to be kind of a balance here. Number four, the reduction of the percentage of dependent persons in the society. The higher percentage of dependency, and that also includes sexual dependency, the weaker the society is. The second thing that we learned from Mao Zedong, and this is the primary reason why the African states are more interested in a communist-type society than an American-type society, and that is Mao Zedong's emphasis on self-reliance. It kind of relates to some things Al was talking about also. You know, where an individual solves his problems, or where a group get together and handle their problems. But the government doesn't solve them for you. And the principle of self-reliance and what goes along with self-reliance is pride of achievement. Inevitably happens. If you solve your own problems, you know, your head is a little bit higher. And so, consequently, the less dependency we can have, the better off we're going to be. One of the primary problems that we have with welfareism is that it doesn't solve anybody's problems. It's, you know, it at best keeps us right where we are. Probably what happens is that the people that are on welfare are slowly going downhill, are becoming increasingly dependent and less capable of autonomous problem solving. And so consequently, somehow or other, and I've got no solution, maybe Al does, I've got no solution in this area, but we've got to come up with a kind of way of handling the problems of people, or helping people to handle their problems, where they are able to be as self-reliant as possible. And if we don't, we simply produce a kind of state that is, you know, that is increasingly dependent. This is why whenever we have welfare state discussions, as we did at Lamont, remember when I threw that little zinger in when you and I were chatting in one discussion, and I asked whether cradle-to-grave security was necessarily the best thing.
orator didn't produce a bunch of domestic cattle that couldn't live on their own if all of a sudden the economy went sour. See, we tend to assume that if life is made completely secure and there are no risks in it, then terrific, you know, that's the way it's to be. And what we don't realize is that what happens is then we lose the capacity to be autonomous because we're kept human beings, and kept human beings aren't persons. They're, you know, they're functions. So, at the same time, we can't leave everybody on his own. He's got to hunt for himself, and I think we're better off with Social Security without it. So once again, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. But if you have increasingly large welfare rolls where all you do is keep them alive, but they are incapable of achieving a point where they do have control of their life, and where they don't continue to, you know, produce second, third, fourth, fifth generation of welfare people, and it becomes a way of life, you're better off if you can lick this problem and have it getting increasingly smaller. You'll never, with any kind of a political society of any size, you are never going to get away from people that need help. You will always have a certain number of persons who by nature are deficient in capacity and who need to be taken care of. You'll always have a certain number of persons who are ill, a certain number of persons who are crippled, and so on. No way you're going to avoid that. In a humanitarian kind of way, you know, you can always take them out and execute them, and then you'll have a perfectly healthy society at all times, but, you know, I wouldn't want to run a country like that. So consequently, you always have to have a certain level of this, but we have to develop some kinds of ways and ideas where we handle the welfare matter in such a way that we don't cripple the people in helping them, but that we strengthen them by the way we assist them. Yes?
When you're talking of cradle to the grave dependency, uh-huh, did you mean cradle dependency where they were depending upon the state?
Like in Sweden, Denmark, things like that.
What I was going to bring up was, like, I work for a big corporation, McDonnell Douglas. Mm-hmm. I have a big fringe package that locks you into a career, really, and you stay there, try to stay there through thick and thin, so that you can keep this package permanently for life, which I've done now. But it is, they've had their claim on you.
You aren't a totally free man.
No, you aren't.
And this is one of the great things about the law which Congress passed last year about retirement programs and pension plans, because it unlocked you.
Yeah, right, the portability of the...
Right, right. I know a few years ago I was much more involved in educational administration than I have been recently. I did a lot of interviewing of people for staffing. And anybody who had been teaching on the secondary level in public system for 10 years or more was simply untouchable. They had so much money invested in the pension plan that they couldn't get out. And they would have preferred, you know, teach on the college level, the secondary level. They were locked in for 20 years because once they got past 10 years, there was so much they were going to lose by moving out of the system if they had to stay in. Well, it was great for the system, but it was lousy for the individual. So what we have now is that, you know, you can take what you got out with you and go into something else if you want.
Mm-hmm. I can make a point, when I was a boy, in 1933 and 34 and so, you know, that I think that WPA did the thing, despite all our criticism of it and jokes about WPA work and all that. I saw the man next door, the first day that he actually got paid for his work is when he had that sense that he was solving his own problem, the thing you were mentioning there. Mm-hmm. He was able to buy groceries as something he had actually earned. Right. And it was almost like turning a light on. And I think that that effect in those days of 1933, the black days, that kind of activity on the part of the government probably forestalled the revolution.
People could have become
bitter enough.
Very likely. And Roosevelt, nobody knows how he got those bright ideas, but Roosevelt, of course, he had some smart guys from the University of Chicago advising him. Political science department.
Right. Yeah.
Tugwell and his buddies. But, he didn't mean too heavily on Harvard. He liked Tugwell, and Ickes had associations with Chicago, and they were pretty much his brain boys. We could very well have had a revolution at that time, and the move for public investment of money in public projects, job creation, and it wasn't only the WPEA, but it was the PWA and the CCC, that did it. And you can, and the CCC, now my wife's father was in the CCC, and he said, but the CCC did, among other things, was prevent a great deal of crime. Because young guys who were, about college age or so, no jobs, nothing, what are they going to do? And the CCC, the guys that age are itchy footed anyway, they want to be on their own, you get around the country, you got out in the wilderness areas, everything was great. But we haven't had any brilliant ideas since then. And we certainly haven't got any right now on the welfare problem.
And then on the unemployment problem, too.
Right. And on top of this, we have developed certain strange ideas about work and about certain kinds of jobs and things of that sort, so that we have related status to certain kinds of positions, and this has created problems also. But anyway, that's an area where something needs to be done. Another area which is extremely important is the open dissemination of information and the possibilities for education. I suspect that most of the countries of Europe are still doing a much better job of education than we are. And Al made some negative comments before. Two areas that I think Europe still continues to do better than we do. One is in the area of professional education or vocational education. And related to it also is pride in one's job. The man goes through a training program to be a bus driver who drives a tourist bus around Europe, and he gets a certificate that he is an official bus driver, and he takes great pride in his profession. And we don't train for professions too well, and we don't train for pride in professions too well. Except for, doctor, lawyer, professor, clergyman. Well, clergyman kind of hurting lately. Engineers are a big deal now.
The only danger there is that a lot, like in Germany and England, once you're a dairy man or, the postman or whatever, your son is expected to be that.
Well, now that has changed quite a bit. They used to be that way, but that's changed quite a bit today for the second reason about European education, and that is that they're doing a much better job than we are about educating those who are able and want to be to the point that they can reach their maximum achievement.
They'll only bring that up in Germany to about 12 or 14 years.
Well, anybody that can pass the exams, can go all the way.
Yeah, right. But I mean,
and get subsidized.
But there's a big cutoff of of the number
that
go on.
They operate with an elite educational system.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. But it's not locked in for the kids of certain people.
Right.
In other words, it's on a testing basis. Now the tests are horrendous and so on. But their ideas are better than ours. And of course, what's happened, our scholarship program is absurd today, isn't it? If you come from a middle class home and you're a bright kid, you can't get a scholarship today.
Mm-hmm.
See, you've either got to come from a home that meets the below poverty level standards, you know, and then you can get money, or be black, or sometimes be woman and start get be an American Indian. And it's almost impossible to get a merit scholarship nowadays. When we all went to college, that was about the only kind of scholarship there was. If you're a bright kid, of course you were going to go to college, because somehow or other you'd win a scholarship. You'd take a test and win a scholarship and go to college. You know, either that or you were an outstanding athlete, in which case they looked out for you. But the whole business of who gets to go to college and who doesn't get to go to college today is really screwed up. And one of the reasons why a lot of the private colleges are having a lot of trouble with enrollment is because their traditional clientele can't afford it. And they can't get scholarships either, because they got too much money to get a scholarship, not enough money to go to college. And so they're just kind of trapped in the middle. So, all right.
That's discounting a huge public education mill that I think is a much bigger factor than that, as far as, I mean, when I can go to the 20 campus state university in California for less than $300 a year, as opposed to, say, even going to Reforest now, at this point, it was about $1,500 a year 6-7 years ago. I'm sure it's over $2,000 now. Yeah. I mean, that's...
You go to New York City and you can go to a four-year university for free, but the city is going broke.
Right, and well, already is. That's part of the reason why. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just really big problem.
We found it with our three children, though, the same thing, very thing you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And what bugged me about it was that here's a case of society saying that after a certain age, that person is no longer your dependent. As a student, he would be. But there never was a law passed that says that the father is responsible to send his child to college. That is, the system of scholarships assumes that it is. So I think where it's really unfair is the young man who is bright, and say in a middle-class family, where his father and mother just don't care about him at all. And so he is blocked out from having that opportunity. If I ever were to say, I'm not going to send you to college, I don't care whether you go to college or not, no law can come in and require me to do that, and yet they deny him as a citizen the right to have that scholarship. So it is an enigmatic situation.
And any kind of situations like this, of course, breed frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And where you breed frustration, you start building tensions and movements in the direction of, you know, you start making your government unstable. Okay, well, we are running out of time, and I got a number more here, so let me just simply mention them. Emphasis on responsibility. I suspect that this relates to the notion also of self-achievement, things of that sort. Our particular problem, I think, for many years is that we have tried to remove the notion of responsibility or of consequence-taking. To protect our children from the consequences of their behavior. This does not help to build a strong society. Emphasis on individual worth. I think this is improving. Development of community pride. Improvement in morality. Today, and I hate to even mention, except from this standpoint, that when we were all young, and we talk about a corrupt nation, everybody immediately said France, and we thought of dirty postcards and Gaieté Parisienne and all that kind of thing. In a very large part of the world today, if you would ask what is the most corrupt country in the world, they would say the United States of America. Number one, they waste energy and materials. What else concerned about? Number two, they are not socially reliable. They're not able to maintain family units. They're always changing. They can't make up their mind what they believe in. And other ones which might be a bit idiosyncratic. If you were looking around the world for countries that were very, very conservative from a morality standpoint, virtually all of them would be communist. You go to the Soviet Union, go to China, and the variety of social morality which you find there is comparable to what we had in the early days of the Depression. I don't know whether there's some relationship between economy and morality, because their standard of living is probably about the same. But they find us horribly immoral, which is kind of hard to hear. But this is a factor that's involved. And the last one, and I wanted to make sure I got that one, because it relates very much to what Al's concerned about this summer, and that is explicit national goals. Now, we have a particular problem in the United States because, by definition, we don't have explicit national goals. We have a structure which is supposed to operate in such a way that we can each have our own private goals, and we aren't going to get one another's hair, and we can be a country. But we aren't bound together by certain kinds of goals, values, and so on. And yet, we have had. And one of the things that a country needs, just like one of the things that people need, is something to live for. And we've gotten kind of disillusioned in the last 10 years or so, because right up until Korea, we were doing just fine, you know. And our national goal was to help the little guys of the world and protect them from the big red bullies. And then all of a sudden, and it worked, still worked pretty well when we got to Korea, although there we got limited success. And then in Vietnam, we discovered that the only way we could win the war in Vietnam was to wipe out every single one of those Vietnamese, who we couldn't tell the north from the south anyway. And the only way to assure success was to flatten every city and to wipe out all the Vietnamese. And then we would know that we had licked the North Vietnamese. See, well, that's not an achievable goal. And so now we're having all kinds of second thoughts about our role in the world. And one thing we don't want to be is the world's policeman, like the British were for so many years. And we don't want to inherit that job. At the same time, we don't want the Soviet Union to inherit that job. And we always have felt close to poor people and poor countries. And we have always wanted to think of ourselves as friends, you know, and to the world, and not discriminating one country against another one. And every time we fought a war, we tried as fast as we could to be friends with the people we licked. You know, and we didn't preserve animosities and envies over a war that we lost 50 years ago or that we won 100 years ago or something like that, as many countries do. But right now we're kind of trying to find a national purpose, and one of the things that really builds a strong country and a politically secure country is if it has national goals clearly in mind and the vast majority of its people committed to them. I suspect energy might be a nice one.
We had a national goal to put a man on the moon, didn't we?
That was a national goal and a kind of relationship. But the trouble with that was it got to be sort of like having a goal to win the Super Bowl game.
Yeah.
See, it was a kind of a synthetic thing, and it was so technocratic. It was so machine science related.
didn't involve enough of the population.
Yeah, it wasn't Lindy braving the Atlantic in his monoplane or that sort of thing. See, we did even when the guys had trouble with the one capsule, remember, and they had to abort the mission and come back, and we really sweated it for those guys. What were their names? See, nobody even remembers.
Neil. You mean the astronauts?
Yeah, it was Neil Armstrong. He was the first guy on the moon, and we'll probably be remembered for that. But the guys whose mission had to be aborted, and it was by sheer guts and brains of the three guys on board that spacecraft that they got back. Because back here, they couldn't help many. And the guys up there figured out how to solve all their problems and, you know, flew back on a seat of their pants. Yeah, but that's the closest that we came, you know, to having a national feeling about things.
Aren't we on the verge of sort of being a peacemaker?
Well, yeah. You know, we have frequently played that role in the world. When we weren't running in to pull somebody's chestnuts out of the fire.
Instead of being the world's defender.
Yeah.
Moving toward the world.
Yeah. That would be a lovely goal to aim at. We might be able to achieve what the Pope in recent years has wanted to achieve. We've got the United Nations sitting in New York there. It's a kind of role that would be natural. It would be unique in history, because all through history, the most powerful nation has always dominated and oppressed the other nations. Because, you know, it's cheaper that way. When you exact tribute for your soldiers being in their country, it doesn't cost your citizens anything. We're accustomed to paying for it wherever we go. But that would be a nice kind of goal to aim at. But thank you all.
Thank you, Paul.
We finally made it, Paul.
Yes, sir. Thank you.